The Association of American Law Schools 1993 Annual Meeting, recorded live January 5th through 9th, 1993, in San Francisco, California. The material recorded on this cassette is the sole property of the presenters and the association, and all rights are reserved. Any unauthorized duplication, transcription, copying, or distribution of the recorded program without the express permission of both the presenters and the association is strictly prohibited. This is tape number 68. A continuation of the Legal Writing, Reasoning, and Research section program.
The drafter, the designer, and the creator. And they need to move through these stages in sequence. If we start them at a designer stage before they've mastered the technician stage, they're going to crash and burn. And many of our students, and I'd ask you to really think about this, is the student writing something that is conclusory because they don't understand what not being conclusory is, so they're over here? Or is the student being conclusory because they're trying to sound like a designer and they're collapsing boxes before they really understand what it is they're doing? So our job is to get in their heads and say, what is it? Why are you doing this? Why did you make this choice? And then I can understand what it is better that you're doing. Another concept that I have running with this is that within each of these stages, there's little steps that students go through and they master these specific skills. And I apologize if you didn't have any handouts. The point is that once they're within one of these blocks, learning clusters, as they master one, the other ones kind of come with the same amount of effort. What happens is, though, when they move from one learning cluster to the next, they tend to hit a raging river. Many of us have seen it, right? They finally can write an objective memorandum. It's simple. There's one case, you know, and the facts are there, and then there's the conclusion, what the court's likely to do, and we're thrilled. Then we raise the ante, and we give them three cases, and they fall apart, and they can't even do what they were doing before. We've seen them all do that, right? And so they've crashed. Why have they crashed? Because they hit a raging river. They didn't know they were hitting a raging river. What they were doing before isn't going to work the same way that they were doing it. They need to modify their skills. They need to modify their approach. We need to tell them, watch out, here's a river, right? And we need to help build those bridges across the raging rivers. And that's what I want to talk about the rest of today. Now, unfortunately, in 20 minutes, I too am finding that do I want to model good teaching, or do I want to give you 20 quick things that nobody will get because I'm going too fast? So I've elected to move a little more slowly and just talk about a couple of techniques that really, really seem to work on many levels. But the second principle I want you to remember, before we can build the bridge across to the next river, the students have to be firmly grounded in the preceding stage. Because if they're not on solid ground there, they're not going to be able to extend and build the and build the bridge, because there won't be a foundation to support either side. Our job as experts in legal analysis is to help build the bridge from the side they're trying to get to, and their job is to become experts at their own learning process. What Lisa's doing is really excellent, because she's asking herself, what is it that I want them to get, and be explicit about it, and she's asking the students to be explicit about why, you know, wait a minute, slow down, what about the preceding sentence that said this only applies to merchants? So she's working on both levels. We can help our students do that by being very explicit about our steps. One way that I do that is I use a technique, a structure, and I'm going to mainly talk about today the technician, moving them from the technician level, because we need to get them grounded there. I can't get them to the designer level till I've had them firmly in the drafter level, or firmly in the technician level. When they get to the creator level, right, that's my daughter then saying, no, mommy, turning the page, it depends on what purpose you're reading the book, right? You know, if the purpose is for me to enjoy reading and like books, let me turn it any way I want, you know, or is the purpose to really read the story? So to get them firmly grounded on the technician level, what I do, I'm losing my time. Oh, good, I'm doing fine. What I do is I start with a very simple concept. I want them first to be able to understand how to identify facts and how to connect those facts to an element of a rule, so their analysis, so they know what non-conclusory analysis looks like. If they know what that is, then I can move them. If they can't do this, we're stuck here. So you can use this, one, as a teaching tool, now middle of the semester. You probably don't want to use this, but you can use it diagnostically. When the student comes in and they're being conclusory, ask them to break it down and show you their thinking, okay? So you can show them their thinking. I give them a simple hypothetical, and what they do is I tell them, okay, this person, there's a whole hypothetical. I'm not going to get into it, but the question is she culpable of receiving stolen property? The three elements of the statute are, and I give them this, right? I'm not asking them to even pull this out. I tell them, these are the three things. These are three elements now. You need to look into the facts situation and tell me what facts tell you, yes, she knew she was in possession of it, and give me the facts, not a check. I want them to put the facts right here, or what facts tell you that she wasn't in possession, etc., right? What facts tell you the property was stolen? What facts don't, da-da-da. Okay, then I give them a real simple formula. Each sentence has to have this and this for their conclusion, right? So good analysis contains the element of the rule plus the legally significant fact equals their conclusion. That's the first principle they need to understand, and they need to internalize somewhat. Okay, if they're not doing this, then I can't do much else with them because they first need to understand this. Now, many students do this right away. They like it, and they use it, and they move on. Then we know we're ready to take them to the next point. If they still can't do this, then we have to back up. I suspect most of your students, when pressed, and they can develop some sort of a model. If this doesn't work for them, you may try something else. They may have to do one more step backwards, which is before they determine what facts support whether or not, they may just need to have an inventory of the facts that might apply to this element. Some students have to start back even a step further. Our job is to diagnose where they are at the level, okay? So I start them with this. Now that I feel that they're grounded and they know how we're supposed to be using facts and rules together, that's all this is about. If they get this, then I bring them up to the next level, which is how do we use a case in legal analysis. Now this becomes a little more challenging. I give them a case that talks about what do we mean by knowledge. You know, how can you tell if the person actually constructively knew? So I give them a case and they have to read the case. And I ask them to fill in these two columns. Tell me the rule or the definition the court gave for what do we mean by knowledge. Okay, so we get something like constructive knowledge equals, right? And it equals X, Y, or Z. These are the things the court's looking at. I don't want to get in substantive law, so be abstract with me in this, okay? Now tell me what facts, what are they doing here? They're briefing a case, right? This is what they should be doing anywhere, right? Okay? Now tell me what facts and reasoning the court looked at to decide whether or not there was constructive knowledge there. So they may cluster fact one and two, right, with some reasoning to hook it back to that. This is a very difficult skill for some students. What I'm concerned about is when we expect that they can already do this and we haven't tested them yet and we're moving them to the next level before they're ready. Here they are, and until they can bring in this case analysis sheet half filled out just with this and get this right, we don't go any further. Okay? So we get them grounded here. Now they get, where's my colored pens? Now they get this. Note how this is just like the fact pattern tree that they were just doing a minute ago. I try and use similar concepts to build on it. Now what I ask them to do is tell me, and again, they may need to back up and just inventory facts, but tell me what facts are more like the fact in our problem. This is our hypothetical, right? What facts in our hypothetical are more like the facts in the case that would then connect back to the rule and the reasoning? Sounds real simple. A lot of students can't do this. And if they can't break their thinking down like this, then we can't ever ask them to write a decent mini brief for their memo or a good argument section because they're not sure what the heck it is they're supposed to be doing. When they can do this, then they're asked to tell me what facts, do the inventory of facts that tell me it's not like. So they end up with fact 4 and 5 or whatever. You with me so far? Then I tell them, here's your memo. Here's your discussion section. Here's your rule section. Here's your mini brief. Here's the plaintiff's argument. Here's the defendant's argument. What do you think the court's going to do? Very simplistic. They can move through this. If they can do this, then we can start talking about how are we going to write it and organize it. Okay? You with me so far? And lose anybody? Great. Then we start to, and we have to move into, what? Then we move into, what's the structure of legal discourse? How is all this supposed to come together? Very simple memo, okay? How do they now use this one case to do it? You get the student who comes in and writes a narrative. Very typical. They're going to write in narrative fashion. So what we have to do is explain to them, be very explicit about the structure of the discourse and how we want them to first tell us what issue they're talking about, what's the applicable rule, what happened in analogous cases. Very simple. At this level, this is all I want them to do. Now, that leads me to principle number 4, which says we need to adjust our expectations and assignments to take into account what learning cluster they're at. We have to do that in order to preserve their sense of self. The student who now feels that she's lost herself because she's given up her voice to take on the lawyer voice, right, has not preserved her sense of self somewhere. At some point, I teach the students the stages and let them know that there's going to be opportunity for them to be creative and look at all the writing now that's being done in scholarship form in the narrative voice that's being validated. So there will be their time, and I don't want them to lose that voice. But before they can make the argument that really turning the page means to get the most enjoyment out of the book, not to proceed to the next page, they need to know the moves to make and make it in the most logical argument. So that's all I'm happy on a first technician level if they can do what we just talked about. Now imagine how powerful it is to then move them up using the same techniques to move it up a level to teach them into the drafter stage. I have this whole wrap on policy, but Lori Zimmet reminded me that I only have 20 minutes and I can't get into policy. Let me just say this about policy. Don't expect them to understand policy without telling them what it is we mean by policy and how it's used. We can't assume that they know what policy means, just like I really couldn't assume that my daughter would know what I meant by turning the page. And sometimes we can't anticipate where they're going to get hung up, but we certainly need to then back up and find out. Now I'm moving them to the drafter stage. Drafter stage means that now they ought to be able to start developing the techniques and skills and judgment to start knowing when to raise and dismiss an issue, when is it something that they really need to talk about, when do they need to go to cases, when do they need to use policy. So now I'm going to explain drafter stage in green, okay? Drafter stage will use the same, we'll use the same problem possibly, or we'll use a different problem that has more cases in it, but we use the same structure. And what we do here is we just say, here's the elements. Now, if there's facts on both sides, right, then you know you need to discuss this. And you probably need to go and look at some cases to tell you what happened in similar situations, okay? What if on this one, there's a fact on this side, there's no plausible argument on the other side? Then you know this is a raise and dismiss. Okay, conceptually? And then when do you know, so here you're using a case because there's a tie. Note how we use cases and policy in a similar fashion. There's a tie. There's two ways that you can interpret the facts. Let's go look at some cases, okay? Here we need to know, well, what do we really mean by knowing it was stolen? So now we hear, we're not sure what facts are here because we need to define what we mean by knowledge before we can ever decide what the facts are. So then we start talking about, well, now we know that we have to go look at cases. And then we're bringing it up a notch. Now I have a higher expectation about what they can do with analogous cases. And I don't expect them, at this point, they're writing pretty rudimentary mini-briefs, right? And the mini-briefs are like two paragraphs long. You know, everything in the kitchen sink happened in this case. And then there's just this one fact that happened out of it. Okay, that's the technician. Now we're moving to the drafter level. Now I can use this same instrument to teach them about synthesizing cases to come up with not only a synthesized rule, because they'll match up. Imagine what would happen if we had three case sheets lined up and each case was adding to the rule, okay? Then they've got a synthesized rule section already written for them. They love it when they figure that this is really saving them time. Also, what happens when the three cases all are giving the same definition, but there's different facts? Well, now they might start being able to organize around reasoning. And instead of having a mini brief A, mini brief for case B, mini brief for case C, and very repetitive, right, they can see how they can collapse the discussion about the analogous cases, because they're seeing in this column it's all the same. The reasoning is all the same. Here are facts here, here are facts here. So their discussion can now start becoming more sophisticated just by having them understand how they're using this technique. And it tends to work pretty well. Okay. Couple other points about this. How am I doing? I got about 3 minutes?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Couple other points that you want to be thinking about. So we're adjusting our expectations. I'm not dinging them. If my student is still at the technician level, I'm not going to criticize the site form, okay? How many of us, right? Those are the students who come to you with the blue book questions, right? The thing's a mess, and they just want to know, are there two spaces or one, you know? You know, do I italicize this word? And you're like, oh, you know, okay? So they're upset. You know, why is it, though, that they want the blue book answer? Because there's an answer. They know they're out of control in everything else, and they want something they can hold on to. So that blue book they sleep with, okay? They're looking at these cases. They have no idea what to do with them. They don't even know where to come in and ask you a question about it. That's how confused they are. If I have them come in, and they're going to talk to me about it, and I say, fill one of these out about the case before we talk, saves me a heck of a lot of time, right? Because I can tell where they're off. They don't even have the rule right. We got to spend time there. Right? Okay. So we move progressively there. Again, what are our expectations? First level, you always want, you want to begin structurally and then move into the content. Some real quick ideas if in terms of writing techniques. Technician level, I tend to focus on teaching paragraph blocks and paragraph outlines to see if they even understand what are the pieces and where do they belong. If I'm at the drafter level, I start talking more about coherence of paragraphs. I start talking about topic sentences as organizing principles. When I move to the designer level, that's where I start talking much more about dovetailing, transitional words and phrases, those kinds of things that help them really appreciate the relationship between the concepts that they're writing. And the creator level, that's when I haven't figured out yet how to teach them much other than, you know, take a risk, make it safe for them to do so, and then let's come back and see if it worked or not. Because that's really where they're doing just breakthrough thinking that's extremely innovative, and that's where I say, they're going to say, no, turning the page means this, and this is why. And they can use conventional logic to justify that outcome. My final point is that mastering these learning clusters is a recursive process. As you noted, I'm using the same two tools over and over and over again as they're moving through the stages. They keep coming back through them. Each time they get a more complicated problem, they have to start the whole process over again. If we're fortunate, if they start building a decent bridge, the first time they move from technician to drafter, they're going to be on a wobbly bridge, and they're going to be holding on all the way, right, shaking and crawling over it. But the next time they move through that, they get a more complicated problem, they feel like they've been knocked back down, they're going to have a more solid bridge that they're building. And eventually they're going to be able to hop, skip, and jump over those bridges, because each time they go through them, they get a better sense of the process of what it is that they're doing. So the things I want to leave you with. We really need a bigger table for these. Did I lose it? What are the things we can do? How can we build bridges? Imperative. We have to first be aware of our own process and model the steps. And model our own thinking process, give them numerous samples. As your student learned, once they saw it, they were at least able to mimic it for a while before they were able to internalize it or make it somewhat of their own. The second thing we need to do is get the students to be aware of their own metacognitive process. And as they become more aware of their own metacognitive process, they're going to be able to tell you why they said turn the page this way, or why they included that case, even though there was no purpose to include the case, okay? They will have a reason. We won't know it, but if we ask them about it, they will have a reason to their own logic, and we need to listen. We need to listen to them, and we need to honor that there is a valid logic to what they're doing. Imagine if I had said to my daughter, wrong. That's not what I meant by turning the page, stupid, okay? What's she gonna do the next time I say, let's read a story? She's not going to want to read the story anymore. She's going to be afraid that I'm going to be disappointed in her again. So I had to say, what I did say to her was, I cracked up, right? I started laughing. I said, that's brilliant, you know, what a genius thinker, you know? And then I said, but what I really meant, you know, is to pick the page up on the right-hand side and move it over and place it on top of the left-hand side, and look, we get a whole new page, okay? So what she did, that is a way of turning the page, and I had to validate that before I could then tell her the way I wanted to. Not that our students are two-year-olds, and I don't think we should treat them like two-year-olds, but sometimes if we go back to a process of simplicity, it's not being condescending, it's being kind. The third point is remembering to begin with the blueprint first, then add the building materials, and then finish with the aesthetics. If you're critiquing somebody on a real finite points before they've got the bigger picture, they're never going to get where we need to get them. So it's really important to move them progressively. So this is a joint endeavor. Our task is to be aware of our process. Their task is to be aware of their process. And we can then together build the bridge. I will help you build a bridge, but I can't carry you across it. Thank you. I forgot. Because I didn't want to take time from my presentation, but we came up with this great idea. Part of what you need to realize is how much you're already doing as teachers, and be aware of how expert you're becoming at teaching legal analysis. I felt kind of awkward getting up here talking to you about it, because many of you have been doing this for a lot longer than I have. We've asked you, we've handed out index cards. If you didn't get an index card, just put it on a sheet of paper. What I'd like you to do is just take a minute during the question and answer period or whatever, if something comes to you later, you can send it to me. Just come up with one concrete thing you did with a student that you didn't think about. You just intuitively did it with them, right? I mean, we all want to be Felix the cat. We all want to have this incredible bag of tricks that we just keep pulling something else out of. Well, I don't know how you all have experienced it, but my experience has been when I'm in conference with a student and I'm really listening to what they're doing, I've come up with just outrageous things that I never would have, had I thought ahead of time preparing for that conference, I never would have done. I had a student read me a case, right? Just read the case. Tell me where the court says this. The student's reading aloud, right? And then I find out that the student, as your student, stopped reading at a certain point, right? Not a careful reader. Well, then I was able to diagnose. So if you would, on one side of the card, write down a simple, concrete thing you've done where a light went on. And on the other side, if you want to hear from us, put your name and school and address. And if you don't want to hear from us, just give us your idea. And just we'll collect them at the end of the thing. We'll pass them forward or something. Okay? Thanks.
Okay, we have a few minutes available for discussion and questions. Anybody? David.
I wanted to ask Lisa about something. I think it must be in the forefront of the idea of moving these ideas into a substantive classroom. And one of the things that I'm trying to do with that last community is to get...
The question is about how most doctrinal teachers do less of this than what I described, and about the conflict between teaching doctrine and teaching people how to think about law. And I guess the way that I came to it is partly from having done 3.5 years of full-time skills teaching before I started doing doctrinal teaching, and having done a lot of very close, intensive, one-on-one tutorial teaching with students in the clinic. And so knowing just how complicated it is to really communicate with a student about thinking about a legal problem. And the reason that once I started doing doctrinal teaching, I was more interested in doing this than doing that is because teaching doctrine always seemed sort of, not to dump on it, but boring and useless. And that teaching people how to do something that they'll then be able to use seems really exciting and dynamic and wonderful. I haven't had a whole lot of interaction with colleagues about it, except one or two like-minded people. But we have conversations from time to time in which we talk about what our teaching goals are. And I think just creating fora in which you can have those conversations about what people are trying to teach and why gets people started down that road.
David, do you want to mention the retreat that you may be having?
Yeah, well, we're organizing in conjunction with people who are involved in academic support, Clarence Downey, the manager, to come to CUNY to do a workshop with our faculty on learning method, learning theory and cognitive science as it applies to traditional law school teaching, to doctrinal teaching. And I think it's something that we should all be thinking about, because what occurs to me is that what we're doing in our classroom, the students are not getting that kind of support, they're not getting that kind of leeway or flexibility or encouragement or opportunity in their contract class, in their course class. And the clusters that Paul is talking about are happening in Paul's class, but I bet that the course teacher is a few clusters of further along in her expectation, or his expectation. And Paul is, so I think that these things are really critical for the rest of the faculty to hear about and start doing.
Okay. Hi, I'm Laurie from Santa Clara University, and I really enjoyed your emphasis on process. I'm the one who told Paul not to talk about policy. I would love to have heard. I like your emphasis on process and the how the students are developing their analytic skills compared to what they're successful with. My question to you is, it's a wonderful concept. You mentioned that you were laboring over exams, and the thing that occurred to me as I'm sitting is, if you have less substance, is it the traditional format, the hypothetical, and then if the emphasis is on process, does it reflect what you are teaching, what your goals are?
Can you repeat the question?
Well, okay, I guess the question is about testing this material. See, I think that most traditional law school exams do teach this, that the problem is not that we don't test them on legal analysis, on their legal ability to do legal analysis. The problem is that we test on it more than we teach it.
This program now continues on side two. Please turn your cassette over now. Thank you.
Again, going back to the other questions, one of the ways that I came to this is by seeing in their exam papers just all these really basic things that they were not doing. I found myself writing conclusory all over everybody's exams. And I use my exams really as feedback to try and get information about what it is that they can't do that I need to get more explicit about the following year. I do cover a skeleton of sort of traditional contract law. My course has a beginning, a middle, and an end, just like anybody else's. I just don't have as many details. I mean, I work with a smaller number of rules. And so I think my testing is pretty standard.
One more question, right in the front.
Regular law school exam, along with writing assignments throughout the year that involve writing, they're seeing why they're analyzing, they're being able to see, as you said, that scope of the rule of law and how it works and what we do with it. And so I think that that kind of approach incorporates a lot of what people have said about learning the analysis.
Okay, good. Well, thank you very much for...
Pass your index cards to the aisle, and will the aisle people pass them forward?
Okay.
Thank you.
I'm sorry. Turning this back over to Richard for our business meeting.
I know there's a temptation to skip the business meeting, but I would ask you to stay. There are a couple of matters of importance to the section. The first one is the election of a secretary, and the nominating committee's report will be given by Diana Pratt.
The nominating committee consisted of Mary Lawrence, Richard Newman, Dennis Hines, Linda Edwards, and myself. And after considering the credentials of the people who've been nominated for the position and the essays which they had written on what the future of our field is about, we would like to nominate Katie McManus to be secretary of the section.
Nobody paid any attention.
Is there a motion to adopt the report? All those in favor of adopting the report of the committee, please raise your hand. All those opposed? The report is adopted. The other matter of business involves amendments to the bylaws, and the report of the bylaws committee will be presented by Katie McManus. Katie here?
No, she's not.
Okay.
Oh. The bylaws committee consisted of Barbara Child and Dennis Hines and myself. Basically, the revisions incorporated changes so that the bylaws reflect the practices of the section and incorporation of required language as to the dispensing and spending of money.
If you're still in the room and are conducting a conversation not related to the business of the section, could you please take the conversation into the hallway, because people in the audience are having a very hard time hearing the report being delivered by the committee. Thank you.
Just to recap on the revisions, the nature of the revisions. One is simply to reflect the practice of the section. There were a few changes that distorted what was really the practice of the protocol, various protocols. Secondly, we incorporated language that was required to be incorporated by the AALS. And lastly, we just made some plain language changes. We have presented copies of the revised bylaws on the back chair as you entered. We present them to you for your consideration, and we request your adoption.
Is there a motion to adopt the report of the committee? Is there a second? All those in favor of adopting the report of the committee, please raise your hands. All those opposed? It is now my pleasure to do my last act as chair of the section and to turn over that office to Dennis Hines, who is now chair of the section.
Thank you, Richard. The chair-elect is Diana Pratt. The secretary is Katie McManus. And our program chairman for next year's program is Nancy Schultz. I accept this position as chair with real humility, considering the standards of excellence that have been set by others in this section. For example, my immediate predecessors, Richard Newman and Mary Lawrence, have set very high standards of intelligence, of deep concern for the welfare of the section, of kind and courteous treatment of people. I will do my best to meet those standards. Thank you. Okay. This meeting is adjourned.
This now concludes this presentation. Thank you for listening.